the rivers run down, but the seas do not fill. From there they return, whence to trickle forth still. The whole matter tires one, so man can't arrange a satisfied eye or ear, hearing full strange. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 7 and 8. That was, which was our daily proverb for today. Little children, from 2004, the version of yours truly. Continuing our study, should make the text larger. Yeah, we saw in chapter 10 a remarkable thing where Robert Whitelaw, I'm trying to remember his middle initial, we're going to go back to chapter 10 and look at that, but Robert, I'm thinking it's Robert L. Whitelaw, or is it Robert A. Whitelaw? Robert L., I think Robert L. Whitelaw. Let's go back and see in chapter 10. It's 11, 9, Robert L. Whitelaw, right. So the greatness of chapter 10 was, as we saw, but let's review it, that Whitelaw's efforts proved the deluge, the date of the deluge, specifically to an approximation which approached very close to what we had in our chronology also, and to what other people also have proposed who are using the longer chronology from the Greek Septuagint, which necessitates going back to about, well, precisely in our case, 3282 BCE for the deluge. But roughly 3000 or so BC would be the approximate range which is gained by the Greek Septuagint, because the generations of how old each father is when he begets his son are longer in the Septuagint. And that's what results in the chronology going back further to the time of the deluge in those chronologies that use the Septuagint version. Now, the brilliancy, the greatness of Whitelaw's efforts were that he only used journal publications, and he used a publication more specifically called Radiocarbon, that publication, which is a journal that, as the name suggests, presents essentially exclusively radiocarbon information, right, and radiocarbon science in that journal. And all of the measurements that had ever been made and published in that journal, that is, of the ones that had been published in that journal, all the measurements that had ever been made were evaluated by Mr. Robert Whitelaw. And he was able to see, by looking at those and counting how many measurements had been made that achieved or resulted in dates that were in each time period. For each time period, he counted the number of dates obtained using radiocarbon in the entire journal of radiocarbon up to his time, all the publications that had ever come out in that journal. And when he counted them up, we saw the distribution. We saw that he saw it too, that there was an increase in the population. We're assuming always here that all other things are assumed to be equal. So assuming that, if there had been, for example, to assume something different, But if let's assume the random distribution first. If everything had been random, and the number of life forms on Earth had been a constant over a long period of time, then we would expect to see the number of measurements obtained during the different time periods of radiocarbon stay constant. But why would it change unless there was some catastrophe, right? But we saw from Mr. Whitelaw's work that the number of measurements rose rapidly around the time just before the deluge, and then suddenly dropped to essentially zero, and then began to rise again after the deluge. So that in the world view where there was a deluge, for believers in the deluge or in the Bible specifically, which mentions the deluge, for those believers, that sudden change did mark the time of the deluge in the radiocarbon. It was marked. And remarkably, he just counted up the number of published dates, you know, in each time period. That's all he did. It was an incredibly great thing that he did. And then, because of what he obtained, of course, also, But he was also a Bible believer, and he didn't just do it as far as his other, the other aspect of what he did. He didn't just come up with his correction in chapter 10. In this table 10.1, he didn't just arrive at this using some, you know, values of dates from that radiocarbon journal. I don't think he could have, because there could be dates that were older than 7,000 years that had been published in that journal. But he did not believe that any value could ever be measured greater than 7,000 years actual age, no matter what the measurement was. Even if the radiocarbon date obtained was infinity, an infinite number of years before present, in other words, zero carbon 14 present, even if that had been discovered, his table would have corrected that 0% carbon 14 or infinite age down to 7,000 years. That would have been the correction that he made. So everything in his correction table was corrected to the maximum of 7,000. It approached that maximum, as we showed in the graph. Asymptotically approached that point of 7,000 years, that date of 7,000, which is the horizontal line here. This is the graph showing his table rising linearly at first and then asymptotically approaching 7,000 years during the years prior to the deluge, which are older in terms of measured years. As the samples got older, they, in his view, would never have really been older than 7,000 years, because that was going back, in fact, not just to the deluge, but all the way back to the creation in about 7,000 B.C., or before present, rather, 5,500 B.C. in our chronology. But that's about, you know, 7,500? Yeah, it's about 7,500 before present or so. Or is it? Let me think. 5,000? No, 1950. That's right. 1950 is before present. So that would add another 50 to it. Yeah. Yeah, but we have 5,550. We have 500 years different at the time of Adam from what he has, or maybe 450 years different. But, you know, we have it somewhat different, but it's certainly reconcilable, right? Whereas when you have somebody who doesn't give the number of years from the Septuagint in dating the deluge, and they only have the deluge in 2400 BC or something like that, it's much harder to reconcile our thoughts with those ideas because they differ by so much more. They differ by 1,000 years almost from our date of the deluge. And so here Mr. Whitelaw only differs by about 500 years for our date of Adam. That's not too bad. Not totally or not inconceivably reconcilable, or not inconceivably irreconcilable. It's conceivably reconcilable. So, wasn't that a lovely graph we did there? I mean, that was something I really enjoyed doing, too. The color graph with all the numbers put on it, showing our date of the deluge, which would have been calibrated years 5,231 years before present in the calibrated radiocarbon dating. And typically radiocarbon is never given as calibrated, but it just was it can be. But also the deluge at 3,282 BCE is the same as 5,231 years before present calibrated. So Mr. Robert Whitelaw did remarkable work here. He not only, we didn't agree with his corrections after the deluge. There's not that much correction that was needed there. And we know that because of the graph from chapter 8, which showed such a good agreement between the radiocarbon and the chronology of dynastic Egypt, particularly in our chronology. We saw, and I figured out what these points were too from the other day when we were talking about these points yesterday, I guess it was. I find out these are just other kings, but because they're color-coded according to the amount of correction, so I think these are very similar to 36 years corrected by that much, that is. And that's why they're color-coded the same, but they're not Ramesses II. They're his successors, such as Merneptah. One of them might be Merneptah here, but he reigned from about 1249 to 1239. That's just about in his reign, isn't it? Yeah. So that's Merneptah, this one. But then you see the other ones, and because they're all, every radiocarbon value that we were given from Mr. Bronk Ramsey's report, his article, Dynastic Egypt, something about Dynastic Egypt. Well, we're going to look at that graph. It's from chapter 8. But this is a blow-up or a magnification of that graph, but with selected points only. It doesn't show all the points. But we showed, it's not attempting to show every point. That's why I say select points only here. But these are not all Ramesses, and just like up here, all the blue ones here are not Thutmose the Third either, because his reign ended in our chronology long before 1400, whereas one of those points goes down as low as 1400. His reign ended in began in 1493, ended in 1439, right? So, yeah, a lot of these are actually his. They're Thutmose the Third. And isn't this also a wonderful graph, the color and everything? This was a pleasure to make also. So, in chapter 8, we saw there was another graph. This was the one I wanted to show you that showed how the agreement was. Such a good agreement between Dynastic Egypt and, what's it called? Do we have the name of the article? It's from 2010, Christopher Brock Ramsey, anyway, that article that he wrote, to do with, here it is, radiocarbon-based chronology for dynastic Egypt. And it showed that, and we plotted it in agreement or according to our own chronology. We put each point for each pharaoh in the correct place on the horizontal scale, on the horizontal axis, which indicated the date, right? So by doing that, we showed that, as, and we also put the points in the place that they would be according to Shaw's chronology from 2000, which was the chronology that Mr. Ramsey used. So when we showed the graph, we were able to show that using our chronology, shifted all the points slightly to the left here, in these cases. I think generally that was the major change, right, for all of those, and was the fact that in this time period, around the time of Thutmose the III, all these shifts occurred. From beginning with Thutmose the III and on down to the time even of Amenemope, around 1000 BC. So in that 500-year time period from 1493 to about 1086, or, but Amenemope ruled 9 years, so, sorry, 89 to 79, 89 to 80, 1080, I guess it would be, the end of his reign, something like that. If he reigned 9 years and it was from 1089, yeah, I think his year one was 1089. You see, because, I say that because he was preceded by Smendes. That's wrong. It was Amenemnisa who was preceded by Smendes. Amenemope was preceded by Susen the I, I believe. And he reigned for 46 years, but... No, okay, so Amenemope's a lot lower. Yeah, he was 1039 to 1030, I think. Yeah, that's right. And then 6 years for Osorkon the Elder, from 1030 to 1024. 1024 was the beginning of the reign of Cyamun, who reigned until sometime around, well, for approximately 17 years, perhaps. But he had a year 17 recorded in two places, so at least 16 years. It looks like for Cyamun from 1024 to 1007. Yeah. But the beginning of the reign of his successor, Susen II, was in 1015. No. Yeah. Yeah, 1015, that's right. So, in other words, around about year 10 of his reign, the co-rule began between Cyamun and Susen II. And Susen II, we can account from the beginning of his co-rule in 1015 for 35 years until 980, which was the beginning of the sole rule of Shoshank, also known as Shoshank I in Egyptian chronology, who was the one who invaded Jerusalem or Israel and came as far as Jerusalem and forced Rehoboam to capitulate at that time, which was in the year 973 BCE in our chronology, which would be, of course, lower than this on the graph, or just about, we have, that would be 1500, 1400, 1300, 1200, 1110. So 973 is somewhere right about at the end of the graph there on the horizontal, at the extreme right. That's just about where Rehoboam's year 5 was, and that's when the invasion came from Egypt, according to the Bible. So that's all we have for that. I think we can start talking about some other things now. We really did cover a lot of this, so we saw that we didn't need to do the corrections that Mr. Whitelaw did after the deluge, which was, of course, this time period from 2700, which is the time of the, or a little, well, somewhat prior to 2700, was the time of the Tower of Babel in our chronology. So right about, which is hundreds of years after the deluge in 3282. But this graph would be therefore long after the deluge, and we found there was no need to correct anything here. Well, everything was calibrated according to the dendrochronology anyway, so perhaps it's not clear how much dendrochronology was done at the time that Mr. Whitelaw wrote his article, so I haven't really researched that, so I don't really understand whether his corrections would serve, but his corrections correct in the opposite direction from what the calibration typically does. So it doesn't seem to me that his correction had anything to do with the dendrochronology. They were in the opposite direction. So, and we just don't think that we need to do the correction of Mr. Whitelaw unless it's at the time near the deluge. And we did that, and we saw in the later next chapter, which we'll talk about tomorrow, we saw the result of that. That's it for the study, I think, for the article, Trojan War, paragraph 12, or paragraph 10, but chapter 12, paragraph 10. Paragraph 10 of chapter 12, which summarized what we had discussed in chapter 10, which was all about Mr. Whitelaw's recording of these publication results. That's all he did, the publication results. And he got these amazing graphs. I guess we still want to show this. The graphs, look at the graphs he got. See, the number of animals, or the samples that were dated of the animals and trees, rose rapidly just prior to the date of the deluge, which is 5,000 years approximately before present, or 5231 in our chronology. And that's a brilliant, brilliant result. And then they were cut off at the time of the deluge and then rose again gradually after the deluge. See, the deluge explains it. The flood of Noah explains it. So Noah was real, unbelievably good, and just magnificently great to find proof of the Bible, and just so hard to find in the world that we see today. So I've been studying how you can do a calculation, for example, but when you, if you're going to get a tankless water heater, I'll show you this calculation. It's very interesting. This person did a calculation here, and that was not it. And that's not it. Where is it? Let's see. This is it. Yeah. This is it here. So it's somewhere on the website, diy.stackexchange.com. And the answer here given, it's very, very interesting, and I think it's correct. But 5.5 gallons per minute, that all these things are U.S. gallons, which are going to be, U.S. gallons are smaller than Canadian. So 5.5 U.S. gallons is, you have to multiply by 3.78 and divide by 4.55, which is the number of liters in a gallon of each, U.S. and Canadian, respectively. So you'd get about, what is that, 3.78 over 4.55. Let's get it into a decimal, which is handy to use, shall we? 3.78 over 4.55, what is that? See, there are 3.8 liters in a U.S. gallon, and divide that by 4.55, liters in a Canadian gallon, and you get 0.83. So 0.83 is the ratio. So 0.83 then times 5.5 gallons. See, I have a shower head that only gives 1 gallon per minute because that was a water conservation measure that people were doing years ago, even though my shower hasn't been running for many years. I'm thinking about putting it back in service, possibly. But that would be 4.5 Canadian gallons, roughly. So 5.5 American gallons is 4.5. It's 4.5 Canadian gallons because a Canadian gallon is bigger. Like in Texas, everything's bigger. In Canada, everything's bigger, right? That's kind of the way it is. Not really, but that's just a way of illustration. But at 8.35 pounds per gallon, which is the weight of a U.S. gallon, in Canada, every gallon weighs 10 pounds. You see? 8.35 divided by 10 would be 0.83. See, that same ratio. In Canada, because in Canada, 16 ounces of water weighs 1 pound. See? And in Britain, too, actually. So in Canada, it makes more sense even than it does in the U.S. And so because a gallon in Canada has 160 ounces, and the ounce is different, too, in the U.S. compared to Canada, by the way. That's right. The ounce is different, too. So, we can rest assured that we have the correct ratio for the gallon size because the number of liters in a gallon has resolved that problem, right? But the ounce is different also by about 5% difference between the ounces. I think maybe the U.S. ounce is bigger, actually. I'm not sure by 5%, but it's a bit hard to be sure what's going on. But in Canada, the gallon's bigger, 160 ounces in a gallon. 160 divided by 16 ounces per pound is 10 pounds. But it's very simple in Canada, isn't it? But it took me about 50 years to figure that out, because it's not really taught in the schools, or if it is, we forget very quickly. But look at this. So because there's 8.35 pounds in a U.S. gallon, 5.5 gallons per minute, you multiply times 8.35. Let's do it. 5.5 times 8.35 pounds per gallon is equal to 46, roughly, pounds per minute. But multiplied by 60 minutes per hour, we get 2755. I did that wrong. Let's do it the other way. Let's do it so we can see it. 5.5 times 8.35. Must be nearly out of time. We're doing okay. Times 60, right? Yeah. Times 60 equals 2755 pounds per hour. Okay. The reason why we're doing that is because a BTU per hour is what we need to convert to watts to figure out our wattage. That's the reason why we're using hours here. So we've got 2,755 pounds of water per hour flowing through a faucet head at 5.5 gallons per minute in U.S. gallons. Now you raise 1 pound of water using 1 BTU, a precise amount of 1 degree Fahrenheit. That's what it is. So that's how a BTU is defined. So, and as he points out, the author here, he says, it's not a BTU per hour he's talking about. He's talking about the BTU. And then you have, if you want to raise, therefore, by more than 1 degree, like let's say water is 50 degrees, like it is typically in the earth. In our part of the world, certainly, it's more like 50. Not really hot, like they're saying here. 65 is hotter than 50 by a long ways. But 50 degrees Fahrenheit, let's say. That's what the water is, and we want to raise it to 100 because we don't want to burn ourselves. So I think that 105 would be plenty hot. So that would be from 50 to 105 would be also 55, like he says, 55. So we can just use the number 55 as our degrees of temperature rise. So let's go back here again and multiply by 55. To get how many BTUs it would require, to because it's only one BTU per degree, and we get 151,552.5 BTUs required per hour, because that's how much water was passing through per hour that we used there, 2,755 pounds. So there we have it. Now, to convert to watts, a watt is 3.41 BTUs per hour. So here we've got BTUs per hour now. And now we can divide that by, this part I haven't even done yet, I hope it works. You never know. 3.41, yeah, 44,443 watts, which is 44 kilowatts. Which is, we also can divide watts by the voltage, because the voltage of these hot water heaters, the tankless ones, and any water heater is always 240 volts. So let's divide by 240 to get the amperage, and it would be 185 amps, just like he got. But here's the interesting thing. We don't have to have 5.5. as our flow rate. We can have 1.25. So let's change that 5.5. We can have 1 Canadian gallon per minute, which is what my faucet head is, and that's 1.25 American gallons, because the American gallon's smaller, but it's actually 1.25, I believe, is the pretty exact conversion. Well, 0.83 would be 1 over 1.25 is what that says. Is that about right? 10 over 12 or 10 over 13, is that 0.8? Yeah, because 8 times 12 is 96. See, so it's 8 times 12 and a half is 100. So it is 0.83, very close, except for the fact that the, that's enough, I think. Details. The final result is 42 amps. Well, if you want one, would be less, but that's it. What's the 8.35 again? Pounds per gallon. Oh, yeah, right. Well, that's, yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that would be a 42-amp breaker would be, if you get the flow rate right and if you get the temperature change correct, that's what you end up with. If you can figure it out so that you can only need 40 amps as a breaker, that's quite a difference. So August 29th, 2024 of the Common Era, the time is 1600 hours exactly, North American Eastern Daylight Time, and my name is Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching, and in my behalf, this is Lev Dusty, and this is Cassie, and they're saying bye for now.